Hey everybody, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio. My name is Chuck.
I'm Ben.
And shout out to Kyle, who was with us for the first hour of the show.
Kyle.
Interviewing Lucy Jones from Lexington Film League.
Please tweet Kyle at Bluegrass Bios. It's so lonely. It's like a little ghost town over there with the tumbleweeds going. If Twitter had tumbleweeds, that's our Twitter site. Facebook is hopping. We're good on Facebook. So if you like us, just hop over and say, hey, I listened to the show, Kyle, and we like you.
He would greatly appreciate that.
Yes, he would.
So today in the studio, we've got a very special guest with us, Mr. Frank X. Walker. How's it going, Frank?
It's a little chilly today, but it's good.
It is.
It's warm in here, though. You'll be warm in a minute.
Well, and the sun is bright outside, so I think if you can trick yourself into staying in the sunlight, you won't even know it's in the 30s.
That's true. It's Kentucky weather, you know. You never know. So, Frank, among many things, you're the founder of the Afrolatchin Poets, which is celebrated its 25th anniversary in 2016. Also, the former executive director of the Kentucky Governor's School for the Arts, 2013 Kentucky Poet Laureate, and 2014 NAACP Image Award winner for poetry. Author of Afrolatcha, Black Box Poems, Isaac Murphy, I Dedicate This Ride, The Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evans, Buffalo Dance, and When Winter Come, The Ascension of York, and so many other books currently.
Chuck, isn't it Evers?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Not to throw you under the
bus.
Sorry. I believe it was Medgar Evers.
Yeah, it is
okay,
Medgar Evers.
Good.
Yes, and currently teaching at the University of Kentucky. So how's it going, Frank?
Sounds busy, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you gotta...
When you put it like that, I'm like, who are all those guys? But busy but good. You know, I think that's the... I'm one of those simple bicycles with one gear,
mm-hmm.
and this is the only speed I know.
Yeah.
But it's good to be in a space like Kentucky where writing and literature and books are valued.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as long as it happens, I think I have a place here.
Mm-hmm.
Which helps because it's home, you know, and it's nice to feel at home in your own space.
Yeah, so where are you from, Frank?
I'm from Danville, Kentucky. Edge of Appalachia, the heartland, the home of Center College, title town, you know, annually voted one of the best small towns in America. It's all those things. Also home.
Yeah, Boyle County, occasionally home of the vice presidential debates.
Yes, twice.
Yeah. So Frank, when you were growing up in Danville, who kind of inspired you to start reading and writing? Do you have some folks who really pushed you in that direction?
Well, circumstance and a person specifically.
I'm going to guess a teacher.
My mother.
Oh, that's my second
teacher. The most important teacher.
Most important teacher. You know, definitely a teacher. But it was the absence of a television in our house. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have a television. And I had seven sisters. And I hated them. And so part of my job was to find ways to avoid them, and sticking my head in a book was easy. I mean, they didn't bother me if I had my head in a book. It also began my fascination with collecting books that I could afford, which meant comics, because then they were like a nickel and a dime.
So what kind of comics did you like? Who are your guys
there? You know, I started out with the basic kind of goofy stuff, you know, Archie Comics and Donald Duck and Richie Rich. And then graduated to, you know, all the really good stuff that had drama attached to it. You know, I remember Conan the Barbarian, Beyond Superman and Spider-Man, Red Sonja. But, you know, my lid really flipped when I discovered the first issue of Luke Cage and the first issue of Black Panther. Then it became personal. It wasn't this thing happening in another world, another universe. This was something that seemed to reflect part of my own community, and I was ecstatic. I mean, it just changed everything for me as far as comics were concerned, and I've been a collector ever since.
Yeah, what comics are you reading right now?
I just bought the first four issues of World of Wakanda, which is a spinoff of the new Black Panther series by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and Roxane Gay is co-writing that.
Oh, that's cool.
It's amazing. They are testing new grounds in comics that have not been done before. And, you know, I think that, you know, Marvel's not just doing great things on the big screen, because I saw Logan late last night.
How was it? Do you like it?
It's the bloodiest Marvel movie I've seen so far. That's all I'll say.
Me.
No spoilers,
you
but.
You just sold me.
It's bloody. I was not expecting as much blood. But you think about, I mean, Wolverine, what does he do? He doesn't
shoot. He's got claws.
Yeah. And he uses them. But I won't go beyond that. But, you know, I'll just say that imagine three Logans.
Nah, I think I know a little bit about that. Have you watched the Luke Cage Netflix show? Can you sign off on that
for me? How many times?
Oh, wow. So I need to watch that.
I think the first time I watched it, I was one of those people who binge watched it. I mean, I was warned that, you know, don't start it on a night I have something to do or other work, or I have somewhere to be the next morning early. So I waited till a Saturday morning, you know, about, you know, right after breakfast and just kind of settled in. And the next thing I knew, it was like midnight.
And
I was blinking thinking, you know, what just happened? You know, this is, you know, no commercial interruption, no.
Oh, yeah.
This was amazing. I mean, the soundtrack, the quality of acting, you know, the storyline, the tributes to the original comic, you know.
And it takes place in the 70s, right?
Yeah, they move it up.
So you got production design and sets and cars. And
they kill it. They kill it.
Oh, that's great.
But it's you know, I thought, you know, I was okay with Daredevil and what they were doing in Hell's Kitchen. But, you know, and they introduced, you know, Luke in the Daredevil series at the end. Mm-hmm. So I was looking forward to it.
Yeah.
But they undersold how good it was going to be. You know, I think they could have really done a bigger job. I imagine among Netflix Marvel fans, it's got to be one of the most talked about series out there right now.
Well, I think that's sort of Netflix's MO at this point, is they kind of they like slipping things in under the radar, because, I mean, like, how good is Stranger Things? I even talked about that in the first hour, and it just popped up one day, and I just watched. I mean, talk about make sure you have nothing to do for 8 hours. But what bridged the gap for you between comic books and literature? What was the first literature you
got into? I think I can credit school to that. You know, I think you know, my teachers found out very early that I enjoy reading. And so they put books in my hand. And I also lived in the community, McIntyre Homes. I wasn't old enough to go uptown by myself to the library, but the bookmobile would travel every Saturday morning to our neighborhood. And I never understood why there was the long line, like waiting for this thing to pull up. You know, I'd be the first one on and the last one off.
Like the ice cream truck. Like, how come they're not here?
It was better than ice cream for me. And I would read books on the bookmobile until they kicked me off with whatever the limit was. I think it was like 10 or 12 books. And I would take them, and then, you know, they'd be finished halfway through the week.
Yeah.
And I'd have to wait, you know, or read them again. And then finally I realized that, you know, what I wanted was to have my own book. Yeah. You know, we had those programs at school where you could, for 25 cents buy a book, those little bitty, you know.
The Weekly Reader.
Reader, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I used to buy things about cars, you know, typical boy stuff, you know, sports, cars.
I bought like 7 baseball card books.
We probably own the same stuff.
Yeah. Do you have the one with like the reprints of the old cards? The old tobacco cards. Yeah, I just found those.
And I don't know what happened to those books.
You know, I've got mine.
Well, you didn't have 7 sisters. You know, we always run out of space, it seemed. And that seemed to be the way my sisters would get to me, is that they would torture me through books. You know, either disappear them or... I remember I had my mother purchased the full set to the Childcraft Library, an extension of a... encyclopedia series, you know, illustrated encyclopedia, you know, geared for young people.
Yeah.
And my younger sisters thought they were coloring books, you know, so they would open them up and just, you know, scribble through the pages, you know, and they would drive me crazy. I'm like, you don't know how valuable this is. And they were like, it's a book.
Yeah.
Did you like juvenile fiction, anything geared towards young people, or did you kind of skip that and go?
I made my way through that series through, Nancy Drew, and then the Hardy Boys.
Very cool.
And then Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
And, you know, I was maturing right as I hit Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, we had Encyclopedia Brown when I was a kid. And then I discovered there was this thing called Sherlock Holmes, and then just binged. You talk about binging something.
Yeah, so when that comes back around, you know, to between elementary and Sherlock, you know, speaking of television and series, I mean, what the BBC has done, you know, with those programs and you know, the fan base around the world. I mean, you know, the show.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember going to London, and the number one thing on my agenda, I found out there was a Sherlock Holmes pub crawl.
Mm. Oh, wow. I see.
And I didn't want to do anything else until I made that happen. But it was the highlight of my visit. I mean, I still think about, you know, the little souvenirs I got. And,
that's cool.
Been in all the spaces that were referenced or mentioned in one of the stories. But it's a special place. And when that happens, I think for a second time, you know, as an adult, that's an extension to your childhood. I think that's the mm-hmm. drive of Marvel. If you get all these adult kids, you know, reliving their childhood in this really high quality way on the big screen. You know, I was looking around the room last night, you know, after the movie was over. I don't think there was a person in there under 25.
Wow.
And I think a lot of people don't go to Marvel movies because they think it's for kids.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's that feeling that comics are just, you know, cartoons on a page. But I think with graphic novels and, you know, with a lot of more mature themes to these pieces.
Well, and underground stuff too. I remember when I lived in Chicago, there was the independent comic book store and people would just make their own comics with old laser jets back 15 years ago and take a bunch of copies to this place and they would just put them on display and take a small cut. Well, and some of them are so good.
In Japan, fan fiction is what keeps the whole thing going. You know, people want to sue them for copyright for stealing their characters, but actually it's people making their own comics based on their characters.
That drive it.
Getting people excited.
But look at animation on television. It's not for children. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is on one level, but some of the stuff is so adult.
Yeah.
Adult Swim exists, right? Because people just wanted to make sure people understood that maybe you want to take your kids out of the room for this next hour.
Now, I have a question for you, Frank X. Walker. Now, if you could write fan fiction for any sort of, well, let's say comic book, which one would you choose? Would you pick Black Panther or Luke Cage?
My biggest weakness is Black Panther in the series. And I think I have two copies of every issue ever printed, you know, from the first one.
So he needs his own movie.
It's coming, but it's late. You know, I wanted this movie years ago, but you know, I love the rollout. I love what happened in Captain America, and the Civil War thing and how they presented him. You know, I think it's true to his character. It's created even more interest in him. And I can't wait to see, you know, how they recreate, you know, Wakanda. You know, if they can keep up with what's happening in the comic book, it's going to be amazing. I get excited talking about it.
Well, Frank, I wanted to ask you, where did you discover poetry?
In a book, you know. But I think that the idea of poetry, you know, considering what poetry does, my first poetry was music. Mm-hmm. Music was really big in my house. You know, we didn't have a television, but we had a turntable. We had the big thing in a box on the floor, mm-hmm. you know, that you raise the top and put an album in and drop the needle on and the music came out of it. And we listened to, you know, radio theater. Mm-hmm. But I remember the poetry of, you know, Stevie Wonder when I was a kid, the poetry of Marvin Gaye, you know, the power of those lyrics and how, you know, there were this kind of double layer of meaning that, you know, I enjoyed what I thought I understood, but had no idea that, you know, they were talking about sex on that song, you know, when I was a kid,
right?
Out in the open. And I think that's one of the highlights of that era of music is they didn't have to be gratuitous mm-hmm. about such intimate details. They could, you know, do the same thing that, you know, had been happening in the blues for forever.
Right.
But now some of the stuff is just, you know, almost grotesque and not interesting because it's not creative. I mean, just to go right to the detail.
It's no romance.
But not just romance, but there's no mystery. There's no, you know, there are no subtlety, no layers. It's just it.
I can't remember the name of the comic who was talking about Black Eyed Peas, but he just said, there's no subtext. It's all text. It's like, let's get in the car. Let's go to the party. We're at the party. Mm-hmm. Hey, let's party. That's literally the song that was up there. So who were your musicians that you really liked growing up, either lyrically or melodically?
Curtis Mayfield, lyrically, I think, was a genius for me. You know, I really, you know, I thought he was even more lyrically gifted than and politically sophisticated than Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, early James Brown was very political. Yeah. You know, before mm-hmm. he got so big, it became about just making hits. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
You know, there was a while when, you know, there was a James Brown who had an afro and more dashikis,
mm-hmm.
but you can almost never find an image of him anymore. Yeah. You know, it's usually that older James Brown with his processed hair mm-hmm. and his chest open. And you know, that kind of 60s, you know, sexual revolution, same thing that happened with black exploitation in film. I mean, mm-hmm. I think he fell victim to that and yeah. it kind of killed the James Brown I grew up with. Mm-hmm.
It's out of Cincinnati. I mean, King
Right.
Records.
I mean, he's close. I mean, out of the same waters, mm-hmm. you know, same waters.
Mm-hmm.
So those guys, and then musically, you know, I remember first hearing Isaac Hayes mm-hmm. and realizing that there weren't a lot of words in the thing I was just listening to, but I wasn't sure why I liked it so mm-hmm. much.
Yeah.
But there was something powerful about that thing that spoke to me. And then I remember being somewhere and seeing an album cover with him on it. And there was something about, you know, his masculinity.
Was it Hot Buttered Soul?
It may have been, but, you know, it's like he had I'm sure he didn't have a shirt on.
Yeah.
I'm sure he had, you know, but it was just, you know, very, you know, masculine, like, yeah, this is what manhood is. You know, right when I'm a young teenager, I think, okay, sure. I want to be a man.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good model yeah. right there, yeah. right?
Isaac Hayes.
Isaac Hayes, you know, the voice, you know, I remember the power of Barry White and what happened when my sisters and aunts would, like, you know, giggle about Barry White. And I would listen. And then I listened to a lot of radio then. And you know, I knew what happened, you know, around midnight on, you know, on black radio stations. Mm-hmm. This different kind of music was played. So these ballads and so these wonderful stories that weren't explicit about, you know, sexual mm-hmm. activity, but were just beautiful and romantic, really taught me a lot about, you know, what words were doing and what they could do. Mm-hmm. So this idea of, you know, early learning about, you know, socio-political things and social justice and real life all in the same space, you know, to a beat of what just kind of in the background. So by the time I was introduced to writing poetry, professionally, you know, happened at a different level. Academically happened at a different level. The first time I tried it on my own was, I think, Valentine's Day when I was in the seventh grade.
Mm-hmm.
okay. So, 12,
or the day before Valentine's Day.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so you're 12 years old, 13, something like that?
12 years old, and I'm in love with Delphine Bartleston. And mm. I know she's not listening.
You think she's still got that poem, though?
I doubt it. In fact, you know, when the next day, I wrote it on the 13th. On the next day at school, I gave her the poem inside a card and one of those giant candy bars, mm. right? And I'm so naive that I do this, and then she turns and gives a candy bar to her boyfriend. right. So yeah. At that point, I'm thinking, I hate poetry. You know? yeah.
This didn't work.
This stuff hurts.
Yeah, snake you know? Oil.
This stuff hurts.
And she was supposed to turn her back on her boyfriend and jump into my arms, and that's how it worked.
Well, I was so naive. I never even saw the boyfriend. I didn't even understand.
Oh, you didn't even know she had one?
It never occurred to me to think yeah. that might be an issue or that she wasn't available. Or because I was, you know, I had blinders on.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And plus, she was almost a foot taller than me, too. you know, so it was like this.
It was an uphill battle.
you know, all the odds were against me, and I didn't even realize it. But, you know, she is my first inspiration to write poetry. And I admit that. She's heard about that and laughed about it still. But it wasn't until high school, I had a 9-week course on creative writing. Mm-hmm. And I wrote poetry. I wrote my first short story.
At Danville High School.
And much of the work I wrote in that class ended up being published in our school journal, you know. So my first publishing happened as a freshman in high school. And I didn't realize anything was special about it. I thought this was just what happened in our classroom, mm. shared between fellow students and the teacher. But once it hit the school journal, there was a poem in there about the vice principal.
Mm.
And this was an era when corporal punishment was still legal, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
he loved swinging his big paddle on a lot of dudes, mm-hmm. especially everybody on the football team. and so he had a reputation. But this poem kind of lampooned him, you mm-hmm. know. And people were come up to me in the hallway saying, man, I read that poem, you know. Wow. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
And I was getting pats on the back that I'd never gotten before, not connected to sports. Mm-hmm. And it was brand new. And I remember I liked it. Like, this is, I can get used to this.
Yeah.
And this is for a little thing that I just wrote that just kind of fell out of my head, that I played with the words and made it sound as best as I could. And that's all it is, you know.
Did it rhyme?
Yeah, it did. Okay. It rhymed. Nice. And I remember it was compared him to the Guardian of the Gates of Hell.
Yeah.
So it kind of had a rebellious edge to it because, you know, I used hell in it,
yeah,
which is kind of risque then. Mm-hmm. But I remember that response from people, and I'm thinking, you know, and, you know, my teachers, you know, also motivated me. My English teachers, you know, really tried to, they saw something in me, mm-hmm, you know, I believe, and they really gave me extra things to read, challenged me in ways that made me do my best work in English and visual art. But I think I won the English award for my class like twice in 4 years. Wow. Outstanding student in English. And because I read so much and then, you know, the papers about them. I remember a paper I wrote about, you know, Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Well,
yeah. And, you know, it was just an easy thing, you know. But the West Side Story thing was an extra thing I did that she didn't even talk about, you know. But somehow I stumbled on it in the library and watched it in the library and wrote this paper that talked about it. And, you know, she was like, you know, who is this kid? Yeah. And I thought, well, everybody's doing this, right? I mean, this is no big deal. And, you know, I love reading. And, I always talk about how the library changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the presence of books and literature, even comic books, just made words more accessible. I wouldn't say it was ever easy. It just made it normal for me, you know? Yeah. Like, that was the oxygen that I always had around me. And writing, I think, is a natural extension of being a reader and eventually wanting to say something yourself. Right?
Right. Storing up all that knowledge and inspiration and kind of putting your own unique twist on it and putting it out there. And I think, you know, that's why I think, Frank, you've done so many things that were kind of groundbreaking and brand new. And I think, you know, most notably the Appalachian Poets. Can you explain a little bit to us kind of how that got started, how that movement got rolling?
What, you know,
or where the term Afro-Latcha came from?
Well, all of that. You know, interestingly enough, you know, we never thought about it as a movement at the time. You know, we were just a group of friends who love reading and writing,
mm-hmm,
but in a kind of private way. So we would meet on Monday nights in the Martin Luther King Cultural Center, mm-hmm, where I worked at the time, in the back room for 2 hours every Monday night, and just share this new stuff we've been writing.
Mm-hmm.
And give each other feedback. Only a few of us had been English majors. There were people from the community that didn't even, you know, belong in the UK classrooms, but they were writing. And it was a pretty loyal group. And we had been meeting for a while and without a name, not even thinking of ourselves as a group or an organization.
And just kind of got started.
Just friends. Kind of the momentum built up. We knew who each other were, you know, it was... But it was still a very private thing among the inner group. Then I went to a public reading that involved Nikki Finney, mm-hmm, where they changed the title of the reading. The original title had been featuring these Appalachian writers. Mm-hmm. Then they added Nikki Finney, and they changed it to something else. They took Appalachian out of the title. And I was curious about, you know, why they had to do that. So that evening after the reading, I looked up in the dictionary I had at the time, and the definition of Appalachian was white residents of the mountainous regions of Appalachia. And I thought, wow. So what are the people of color who live in that same space? Because I'd been to Huntington, West Virginia. You know, mm-hmm, I'd been to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
I'd been to Birmingham, Alabama, and Bessemer, Alabama, and Huntsville, Alabama. So, and those are in Appalachia. Mm-hmm. But if you're Appalachian, because you live near the Appalachian mountain range, but if you're not white, what does that mean? So I wrote a poem about trying to interrogate that question for myself. And, you know, because I couldn't afford a therapist, that's what I do. at the end of that poem, you know, Afro-Latchian just popped out. I mean, just it was the most logical thing as I was trying to interrogate that idea. And I took that Monday to the group, and they were like, you know,
like
that word, that dude, that word. I mean, that And we kept talking about it so excitedly that before the evening was over, we decided to name ourselves the Afro-Latin Poets. Mm. I mean, it was that simple.
That's great. Where was the first spot? When was the first time you met Nikki Finney?
In the crosswalk of crossing the street on, I guess we call it the, on Euclid Avenue, right where it crosses Rose at the edge of campus. Mm-hmm. She almost ran over me in the crosswalk. She was a runner. I think she still runs, but she came through and I looked up and this, you know, very tall, regal woman with long dreadlocks, mm-hmm. you know, was a stampede suddenly in my lane.
Yeah.
And I just dodged out of the way and made it to the edge and turned around like, what was that? You know, that person is in the UK.
Yeah.
Then I found out she was, and she taught poetry and I'm taking her class.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the first time I met her.
Well, poets are all about movement. No doubt about that. Well, that's great. And as of now, kind of with the Appalachian Poets, there are multiple generations, right? So how many are there right now?
You know, I lost count. We just took six new members.
Yeah.
around 30 active members, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them still live in the area. But, you know, we're all over the continental United States. Most of the original poets are actually all teaching at some university somewhere,
wow.
which is great. You know, Kelly Norman Ellis is at Chicago State. You know, Paul Taylor is at Penn State. You know, Crystal Wilkinson is at Berea. Mitchell Douglas is at IUPUI.
Mm.
I'm here at the University of Kentucky.
Yeah.
You know, so we're out there. Nikki Finney is back in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Teaching. You know, so you know we're indoctrinated another generation of young poets. And a lot of us also were associated with the Governor's School for the Arts.
Mm.
I think everybody I mentioned either taught for a regular session or came through as a visiting artist at the Governor's School for the Arts during the 11 years that I was there.
Cool. Well, how, yeah, I guess I want to ask kind of, how does someone become a member of the Afro-Latin Poets? Is it kind of invitation only or?
It is. That's part of the reason it's still so small after this many years. I mean, 25 years, I mean, we average about, you know, two people a year, but we really only take new members like every 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually is generated by this, you know, momentum is starting to slow down. We need some young energy to push us all. And they've mostly always been young people we were working with or people we encountered during our travels who seemed to need a family to continue working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we weren't trying to find the most perfect poets, but poets who needed what we needed when we first started. You know, it was the group, the community we built that allowed us to kind of develop as writers
mm-hmm.
outside of a classroom space. And there are a lot of people around the country who, because of their circumstances, don't have the benefit of being in a classroom or maybe have never had a creative writing course ever, but they think of themselves as a poet.
Yeah, and I think that community, and particularly that community at the MLK Center when things were getting started, seems to have really planted a lot of seeds that have gone all over the place. Like, I remember when Sean King was here, when he spoke with Bobby Seale, he was talking about how, you know, that movement inspired him to go on and do the tremendous work that he's doing now. So,
yeah. Well, I remember Sean as a high school student, and he used to hang out in the cultural center, the same space that gave birth, you know, to not just the writers, but even a theater group. Message Theater was born out of the same space in the King Cultural Center, you know, during those 10 years I was associated with the center.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're going to take a quick break.
Yeah, let's take it.
We're here with Frank X. Walker. We're talking about Afro-Latin Poets and all kinds of other things. We're going to take a quick break real quick, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here at 93.9 WLXU.
You
At Doodle's Breakfast and Lunch, we bring locally raised and grown products directly from Kentucky farms to your plate. We do this not only because it tastes better, supports the community, and provides jobs. We do it because it's just the right thing to do. Like supporting this radio station, Doodle's is proud to support WLXU and Lexington Community Radio by bringing you local talent and content that matters. WLXU does for your brain what we do for your belly. Doodle's is open Tuesday through Sunday, 8 to 2, and is located at the corner of Limestone and 3rd. Our small batch, made with love, biscuits, and gravy, is on the special board and runs out quickly. So you can come early and mention this ad for a surprise. Doodle's, it's comfort food with a conscience. And we're a Kentucky proud restaurant. Lexington Community Radio thanks Doodle's for supporting true community radio.
This is Lydia Jacobs, host of Aging Adventures. We keep everyone up to date on what's going on in the senior community in Lexington, conferences available, how to stay healthy. We talk to a wide range of people, professionals, individuals who are paving their own way in the aging world. Aging Adventures with host Lydia Jacobs on Fridays, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock on 93.9 WLXU, a Lexington community radio. But in passing, we'll grow
older every day. Hey, everybody, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU. Coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky, over here on 6th Street. And we're here in the studio with Frank X. Walker, Kentucky poet extraordinaire. So, Frank, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, this last year was the 25th anniversary of the Afro-Latchian Poets. And the Governor Matt Bevin, wanted to present you all with a poetry award, and you all rejected it. So first of all, I want to say thank you for standing up for what you believe in. But second of all, you know, I was kind of curious how that came about and how you all kind of came to the consensus to reject it, and also if you experienced some backlash as because of it.
Sure, I'm happy to talk about all of that. You know, it was officially the Community Arts Award that we were going to receive for our, you know, 25 years of activity in the region. But I mean, as soon as we found out about it, you know, first we were excited, and then secondly, we thought about what that would mean. You know, most of us write about social justice issues, and we were very aware that, you know, the current governor's platform and policies were pretty much anti everything we supported and before. We weren't comfortable accepting an award in the name of directly from an individual whose policies we were, you know, so opposed to. I mean, and his policy on the environment, his issue with felons, though he's rolled back a little bit, in that area. But, you know, if there were 10 policies he had, we disagreed with 11 of them.
gotcha.
And so it was an easy decision for us, you know, and although when we saw how beautiful the award was, it was a little bit of regret to see that beautiful piece of art created by an alumni from the Governor's School for the Arts, Matt Gaddy, you know, it's an amazing potter. There was some regret, but we did not regret that stand. Mm-hmm. In fact, I expected some backlash. A lot of people felt like, you know, it was Frank Walker personally who turned it down, but it was the Afro-Latchian Poets. It was never an award for me. It was for us as a group. And the group was in the conversation, you know, and electronically on the phone, emails, you know, we had this group conversation over 2 days, even hammering out the press release we released about rejecting the award. And we never expected it to go viral. I mean, newspapers picked it up. I mean, it's, you know, but for every individual who expressed some disgust at that decision, you know, I got some pretty hateful emails and messages through Facebook, you know, some pretty vicious verbal attacks. Every one of those, there were 10 people who said, you know, hell yes, you know, thank you for reminding us that as artists, you know, we have a voice, that we have a stake in Kentucky's future, that if we feel this way about these things, we should say something. And so no regrets at this point. You know, in fact, I saw the governor a couple of weeks after that, you know, in the elevator at Commonwealth Stadium. And I don't know that he knows who I am from a can of worms, but there was a look on his face like, that's him.
Yeah.
But he didn't say anything. He couldn't say anything to me because standing directly behind me was, you know, a 6'10" friend of mine who's the Olympic Greco-Roman coach for the United States. So it's like I had my own bodyguard.
Yeah, you know? Right.
He had his, but you had
your detail. Yeah,
I had Luke Cage with me.
Yeah, right. Well, that's amazing, and I do think I think it's important for artists to stand for what their art is about. And you know, Frank, do you think artists have a responsibility to engage in social change through their work if they so choose to, or do you think?
Well, you know, I think all art is political, mm-hmm. even if you believe that. The thing you made was apolitical. It's a political statement. Mm-hmm. You've been apolitical.
Yeah.
But I think there's a degree of responsibility because if you consider the history of art, I mean, there. If you look at what's happening globally, mm-hmm. And there are some places in the world where, I mean, poets have been jailed for speaking out, but they are doing what poets are supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, the poets are supposed to critique the establishment. You know. Who else is going to say the emperor has no clothes?
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. the poet. You know, that's our job. And, you know, there are people who write about the beauty of flowers and trees and that's it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if somebody is poisoning those flowers and trees, right. you know, who's going to write those poems, right? Right. So who's going to protect the environment or find the language to encourage people to recognize that it's happening?
Mm.
You know, so the musicians who have a social justice edge have always been, my most interested group of people that I want to listen to and be informed by, you know, early hip hop, mm-hmm. you know, came out of that same kind of space. So I was a huge fan, and I still am a huge fan of early hip hop, mm-hmm. and indigenous hip hop around the world. You know, I've been to, my son and I spent a couple of summers on the Nez Perce reservation and we're introduced to Native American hip hop, mm-hmm. which still comes out of this space where people have been oppressed
right.
and they're rapping about that. You know, same thing is happening all around the globe where there are communities that feel oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that what's commercial and gangster rap in the United States has kind of ruined, you know, the tradition of rap music in the United States. 'Cause now it's about, you know, profit. It's
yeah.
pure capitalism. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, you know, but fortunately, there's that the good music still exists. You know, you can, there are channels yeah. with just that good music on it.
Right. And I think a lot of it is about illumination about things that people don't know. You just don't hear about every day. And I think you really channel that in your work in a lot of ways of illuminating these figures who've come through our histories that may not have been, you know, spoken upon as much as they really should be. So I wanted to kind of talk to you a little bit about your process and kind of when do you decide. And I guess my question is really, when do you decide that you want to create a volume of work about these characters that you come across in your research?
Yeah, I think every time has been different. Mm-hmm. You know, the first time I did it, it was not even my idea. You know, I was responding to my own personal embarrassment because I didn't know that there was a York who accompanied Lewis and Clark on the Great Expedition.
Mm-hmm.
I'd only heard about those two guys. I didn't know there were 42 people.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I learned about it, the more I wanted to share that information. And, you know, the poems were an easy way for me to do that. And I had written about a dozen of them, not even thinking about them as a volume. And I shared them with my professor, Greg Pape, who's from Montana, who lived less than a mile from the Lewis and Clark Trail. Wow. You know, I shared them with him in the MFA program at Spalding. And he said, you know, dude, this is a book.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gave me two other books about the Lewis and Clark expedition. You know, one about, you know, the animals and plants that were significant as part of the expedition. Then another about a medicine
mm-hmm.
And all the medicinal challenges they had, health challenges they had in those 3 years. And it inspired another dozen poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept buying books and conducting other research to kind of flesh out the whole story. So ended up writing two different volumes, Buffalo Dance and When Winter Come. And I've actually finished a third volume. I've that was sold last year to a California filmmaker. So there's a film coming out about York of the Lewis and Clark Expedition.
We might be able to check out the book. When is that coming out?
The book is not supposed to come out until after the American debut of the film. Mm. You know, so you know, we're probably at least 2 years away from both of those in final form. But University of Kentucky Press, I've already met with them, and they want to publish the third book.
Cool.
You know, since they published the first two, it makes sense.
It makes sense. And I wanted to ask you, since they're mostly persona poems from the voice of York, how did you kind of go about meditating on what York's voice may have been like when you were writing them?
Well, part of it was just trying to do as much research as possible. Mm-hmm. And the other part was trying to imagine myself in the same situation. Mm-hmm. You know, once I had all the details, you know, research, memory, and imagination are the three things I think you need to write any poem. Mm-hmm. You know, this was, you know, over 200 years ago, but there was a lot of research available in person and, you know, firsthand, you know, third-hand accounts of what happened. But for me, one of the kickers was having the privilege of visiting Ed Hamilton in his studio in Louisville, who was also researching York. And he had been hired to do what is now a 9-foot-tall bronze statue of York, of his idea of York. And I would go visit the studio when I had writer's block. And I remember I hadn't written a thing in about a week. And Ed, at that point, had not put a face on his sculpture. And this was a clay version. The clay version is actually pictured on the cover of the book. But at night, he covers the piece with plastic. And because of condensation, when you take the plastic off, the whole thing is sweating, technically.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And he had finished the face that week. So I go visit Ed. I walk in the studio. He pulls off the plastic. York has a face now, and he's sweating. And I'm looking at him, and I never said a word to Ed. I just nodded, and I just turned around and went back home. Mm-hmm. And I didn't sleep for 2 days. I just wrote nonstop. I mean, I was so... It's like suddenly he was real to me, and I could hear his voice even clearer. And before that, I felt like I could hear his voice, but now that I had his face, he was real. Mm.
Well, now I've never heard of this guy until today. Tell me a little bit more about him, and where is he from? What was his position?
You mean York?
York.
I guess is that you're asking about?
Yeah, York.
Yeah, York was a personal manservant of William Clark, and you know, he was he lived here in Kentucky when Merwin Lewis came down the river and met Clark, you know, in Louisville, just across from downtown Louisville. And there's a state park there in southern Indiana, you know, where they, you know, landed. But, you know, York and I think 9 young men from Kentucky, because of their hunting prowess and their ability to survive in the wild, were all hired. Well, York wasn't hired. He just had to go because Clark went.
Yeah.
So the other 9 men were hired, but they technically, you know, belonged to the Army because it was an Army Corps that were part of the, you know, that conducted the exploration. And they were gone 3 years. But York, the thing about York was that he was a slave, but he carried a gun, a knife, and a hatchet. And physically, he resembles what we would recognize today as a NFL defensive lineman.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Looking at the book cover.
So, I mean, he was a huge man, but he was as nimble as a small man. And the journals, there are 3 versions of the journals. And they talk about in the journals how amazed Native Americans were when York danced or the amazing feats of strength he performed by, you know, he would put people on both arms and raise them up and swing them and carry them around. Mm-hmm. So they see this huge man, strong man, dancing man, very African features. And the response to York in Native America was so dramatic that they thought he was magical. Mm-hmm. In fact, they called him Big Medicine.
Yeah.
They thought he was the most magical thing that, you know, they had a compass with magnets in it. You know, they had the looking glasses and binoculars. But they thought York was the most amazing thing. They had never seen a black man. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they arranged for York to sleep with a young maiden, hoping that she would become pregnant so they could keep some of York in their tribe.
Wow. Oh,
and they would stand guard outside, you know, that housing space to make sure nobody else, you know, interrupted or participated. Yeah. I mean, this was a big deal.
Yeah.
And to find out, you know, a year after the book came out, that not only, you know, was he privileged that when he was with Inez Pierce, he actually married the daughter of the chief, one of the chiefs, Inez Pierce, Chief Red Grizzly, and they gave birth to a son who was also named York. Mm-hmm. And I had a chance to meet the descendants of York who are Inez Pierce and still live on the reservation this many generations later. They know the story. They're very proud of it. I remember being in that space the first time and thinking I just saw two of my grandchildren run by, mm-hmm. you know. And it turns out, you know, both of those kids are now, one's a college freshman, one's a high school senior. Wow. And they were the sons of the current chief who was married to an African-American. And so it was beautiful being in the space even now to see, you know, what those kids would have looked like because, you know, they're still intermarried with African-Americans. But that particular lineage is honored in the tribe. And that's, you know, that'll be the kind of the crux of the movie that'll be made.
And I think one of the most beautiful parts of Buffalo Dance is that when York pretty much saves Lewis and Clark's life, you know, is almost a diplomat on behalf of them with the native tribes.
Yeah, there are at least three occasions in the journals where York's presence saves everybody's life. You mm-hmm. know, at least twice Native Americans, you know, see them coming and think, let's just kill them all.
Mm-hmm.
And then go, wait a minute, you know, what's that? You know, mm-hmm. who's that guy?
Wow.
We need to find out what that is before we kill them all.
Mm-hmm.
And then they discover York. And it wasn't just his physical self. It was also his character, you know, the way he conducted himself that they responded in such a positive way. So it was easy to be inspired to write about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't wait to see how he's realized on the big screen. You know, yeah. I'm so excited about that.
Well, I can't wait to check that out.
That's
going to be great. So Frank, can you tell us a little bit before we wrap up here about Pluck and kind of some other projects that you have going on?
Yeah, Pluck is something I'm very proud of. The 14th issue just came out at University of Kentucky. It's published out of the Arts and Sciences College, thanks to generous support from the dean. But for the 25th anniversary, we were able to have a special issue of Pluck that's actually an anthology of the work of Appalachian poets over 25 years.
Wow.
But of course, having a small budget, you know, we were only able to print a few more than our subscription base.
Mm-hmm.
But we have entered into a very happy arrangement with the University of Kentucky Press, who's decided to reissue Blackbone, which is the name of the anthology, in the spring of 2018 as one of their own products.
Mm-hmm.
And we happily give it away just to see it in print, to share with people this amazing collection. I mean, we're so proud of it. You know, Jeremy Payton and Bianca Spriggs worked so hard to edit and put this together. And, you know, people always wonder, you know, well, who are the Appalachian poets? You know, we have, you know, scholars, you know, we have Latino members, you know, people from all over the region represent here, including Nikki Finney and Crystal Wilkinson and Kelly Norman Ellis, Danny Quintos, you know, really, really proud of this work. And can't wait for the general public to get their hands on a copy.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Frank, is there anything else you have coming up that you'd like to promote or let people know about? Or where can people go to check out more of your work?
You know, I think just raid a bookstore is the best way.
That bookmobile comes in.
If the bookmobile
comes bashful.
In, yeah, there better be one on there. And other than that, you know, April the 2nd in Danville, we're having another thing for artists. This time we're going to be more intentional about equipping artists to go back to smaller communities to organize themselves and to take over or to participate in local government, you know, public education. And even hopefully some of them to run for local offices so that we can not just, you know, be part of decisions being made, but maybe influence the policies that affect the arts in Kentucky. You know, we really think the arts are Kentucky's number one product, not bourbon, not horses, but the arts. And we're just not telling our story loud enough.
Yeah, agreed.
That's great. And when, you know, have any idea when that might be? when that meeting will be?
It will be April the 2nd at Danville High School. Did I say April 2nd? That's a Sunday. April the 1st, Danville High School.
On a Saturday. April 1st.
No joke. Saturday, April 1st, Danville High School in Danville, Kentucky. The agenda will be available online. So try to find me online.
Where can people find you online? Where can they pick up your work?
You can read all about it at frankxwalker.com.
Cool.
And on Facebook, Frank X Walker. I think the only Frank X Walker there.
Yeah. And what classes are you teaching in the UK in case people want to sign up?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm currently teaching a wonderful English 107 Intro to Creative Writing course that has about 135 students.
Wow.
I teach in a graduate program also. I'm teaching English 607, which is a workshop and a course for poetry, and 608 is a craft course. So mostly Intro to Creative Writing and poetry is the way to find me in the classroom at UK these days.
That's awesome. Well, Frank, thank you so much for coming in and talking.
Oh, man, I wish we had more time. I had some questions written down we didn't even get to.
I do, too. Yeah. A lot to talk about.
If you missed any part of the show, you can go to lexingtoncommunityradio.org, and Bluegrass Bios is there. We are on iTunes. We are on SoundCloud. Subscribe. Give us a good review and all that.
And, Frank, I was wondering if we could wrap up, if you don't mind reading the poem Appalachia from the book of the same name.
Sure.
It kind of got everything rolling.
Mm, cool. Be a nice way to exit.
I think so.
Appalachia for Gurney and Ann. Thoroughbred racing and hee-haw are burdensome images for Kentucky sons venturing beyond the Mason-Dixon. Anywhere in Appalachia is about as far as you could get from our house in the projects. Yet a mutual appreciation for fresh greens and cornbread, an almost heroic notion of family and porches, makes us kinfolk somehow. But having never ridden bareback or side saddle, and being inexperienced at cutting, hanging, or chewing tobacco, yet still feeling complete and proud to say that some of the bluegrass is black, enough to know that being colored and all is generally lost somewhere between the Dukes of Hazzard and the Beverly Hillbillies. But if you think making shine from corn is as hard as Kentucky coal, imagine being an Appalachian poet.